This is Jim Inkster. Coming today, we'll visit with John Heilemann, the national affairs editor for New York Magazine and a political analyst for MSNBC. Along with Mark Halperin, he has written a book, Double Down, Game Change 2012, a book about the presidential election of last year and how Barack Obama managed to win by almost 5 million votes in an election that many thought, on election day, would be a cliffhanger. What happened? Also, on the show, we will visit with State Police Commander Mike Edmondson. He has some thoughts about law enforcement, including school safety in Louisiana, and we'll hit him on a few different issues. And we'll have the latest from Swine Palace. The premiere of Dove is about to happen. We'll find out all about it today. But first, the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, it's 877-217-5757. We start with John Heilemann, national affairs editor for New York Magazine, political analyst for MSNBC. He's collaborated with Mark Halperin, as he has before, with Double Down, Game Change 2012. It's about the 2012 election won by President Obama by nearly 5 million votes. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Baton Rouge.
Good to hear your voice. And how did it happen? On election day, Mitt Romney apparently thought he was going to win. He not only didn't win, he lost in a rout. What happened?
Well, that's a very big question to start with. I think, you know, Governor Romney's team had a somewhat outmoded view of what the electorate was going to look like, and President Obama's team understood it a little better than they did. That accounts for the disjuncture between Governor Romney's expectations and the outcome. But the larger story, I think, is, you know, over the course of 2012, President Obama managed to discredit and disqualify Mitt Romney. He spent a lot of money to not so much to run on his record and not so much to run on his plans for the future, but on to turn the election into a choice and make Mitt Romney unacceptable to enough of the American people that President Obama, despite all the economic headwinds that he faced and the shaky approval ratings and all the problems in his first term and not having a lot of really popular policies with a lot of people in the country, he was still able to to win a pretty decisive victory.
You note that Joe Biden was not always the certainty to be on the ticket. Ultimately, he was, but there was consideration to removing him. What happened there?
Well, you know, this is something that the White House, there were rumors about this that went on for 3 years, always denied by the White House that there was any ever consideration of getting Joe Biden off the ticket and replacing him with Hillary Clinton. But we report in the book that at the low ebb for the president in the fall of 2011, you know, when his approval rating was down around 40%, and he's just coming out of the debt ceiling fight with Republicans, where he was, you know, really kind of beat up. Republicans thought he looked weak. Democrats thought he looked weak. At that point, the president's team, at the very highest levels, from his chief of staff, Bill Daley, to his top political advisors, they decided that it would sort of be a dereliction of duty not to look into whether it made sense to think about putting Hillary Clinton on the ticket. So they went out and did what those guys, you know, get paid to do, which is research. So they spent a lot of money to do some polling and to do some focus groups to ask the question, you know, how much would it really help Barack Obama to put Hillary Clinton on the ticket? Something that no one had ever really acknowledged that they'd done before Double Down. And they went out and did that research and discovered that, in fact, Hillary Clinton didn't appreciably help President Obama's odds of reelection. So they didn't have to go any further with that. But it really is a testament both to how dispensable they thought Joe Biden was, at least the president's team, not necessarily the president, but also just how concerned they were in the fall of 2011. A lot of people say, well, Barack Obama's reelection was always a foregone conclusion. It certainly wasn't that way to Barack Obama and to his top people in the fall of 2011. They thought he was in real trouble and was, you know, at best a 50-50 shot, possibly an underdog at that point.
Well, the periphery of the book, Double Down, is populated by many people, as your 2008 version was. But Hillary Clinton on the Democratic side, obviously, is a major player. And on the Republican side, you've got larger-than-life Chris Christie. Did he help or hurt Mitt Romney in 2012?
Well, yeah, I think he was one of the most He's one of the best spokesmen for Mitt Romney. He provided Romney with a degree of kind of when he was out campaigning for him and raising money for him, was a kind of great surrogate for Romney but he was also a guy who was tough to deal with for the Romney campaign. A lot of people on the Romney campaign felt that his convention speech in Tampa was more about Chris Christie than it was about Mitt Romney, and certainly they felt when in the final days, when Mitt Romney wrapped Barack Obama figuratively and literally in a big bear hug after the superstorm Sandy hit New Jersey and the New Jersey shoreline, there were a lot of Governor Romney's people who were not very happy with what Chris Christie had done. Especially in those closing days of the campaign, kind of felt like he gave Barack Obama a boost rather than Mitt Romney a boost. It's a complicated relationship, but one that if you read the book, you'll kind of see all of the things that are both assets and some of the things that are not so good when it comes to Chris Christie and why he's such a fascinating figure.
John, you note that the president delighted in his exchanges with Donald Trump. He thought Trump was helping him, obviously.
Well, he starts out at the beginning of the book a little bit troubled by Trump, in the sense that not personally, because when Trump was driving the question of the birther story about whether Barack Obama was born in the United States or not, the president knew that he was born in the United States. He didn't have any question about that in his mind, but he thought that Trump was consuming an awful lot of media oxygen, and it was a big distraction. So for a while, he's kind of tormented by Trump in some ways, but then, of course, he releases his long-form birth certificate and then mocks him at the White House Correspondents' Dinner in the spring of 2011, and the president took great glee in doing that. And then later on in the campaign, when Trump's association with Romney ended up being something that the Obama campaign thought really hurt Mitt Romney, it made people in the middle of the electorate think of Romney as a plutocrat, and they used pictures of Romney getting with Trump's private jet behind him. They used them over and over again in Obama ads to sort of telegraph the notion, this guy Mitt Romney is not like you, he's a big plutocrat like Donald Trump. Every time President Obama would see that shot in one of the Obama ads, he would sort of laugh and say, wryly note to his, oh, we got that Trump picture in there again. I see you guys are doing your doing your work to tie those guys together in a big bow.
Well, the book is full of delightful characters. Some might find not so delightful, but if you watch the 2012 campaign evolve, as most of us did, Double Down captures it in all its glory and lack thereof. What about Rick Perry? You've come through with some interesting information about him that I had not known before. He had health issues?
He did, and it's one of the things Governor Perry, when he first got into the race, a lot of people thought he was the guy. He was going to be the Mitt Romney killer, and he'd been such a huge figure in Texas, getting reelected three times and being able to raise a ton of money, people thought, and great retail skills, people thought. Turns out that, he had back surgery right before he got into the race, which I think is one of the great lessons of Double Down, which is, if you're going to run for president, don't get major back surgery just a few weeks before you enter the race, because presidential campaigns are pretty physically arduous. One of the problems for him was that his back surgery kept him from being able to run. And Governor Perry is a runner for one reason, which is that it helps him get over what has been for his whole life chronic insomnia. And so once he got his back surgery, he couldn't run. And once he couldn't run, he couldn't sleep. And so this is a guy who started the presidential campaign relatively late with a very, very, very jammed schedule. And now he's unable to do the one thing that allows him to sleep at night. So within a few weeks of entering the race, Perry is comprehensively exhausted. And if you think about some of the debate performances that did so much to sink his candidacy, a lot of those had to do with the fact that this guy was really, really running on fumes, not sleeping, not being able to prepare for these debates. And his performance failures, I think, owe directly to those, and this is one of the things we detail in the book, but one of those, his performance failures really owe directly to just his state of manifest exhaustion as a result of the surgery that he had over the summer.
At one point, it appeared he was intoxicated on the campaign trail.
There were people who noted that. I do not believe he actually was intoxicated, but if you were to go and Google Rick Perry drunk, I'm sure that video would come up and you would could draw your own conclusions.
What about the first debate? It was not a great performance, and that's an understatement for the president. How did he disintegrate in that first debate?
It's a story that we spend a lot of time in the book on the first and second debate. President Obama, a guy who really distrusts the theatricality of politics, is a guy who also had a lot of contempt for Mitt Romney. The combination of those two things, his distrust for the whole theatrics of it, with the fact that he felt like he wanted to fight with Romney, but his team thought that it would be a bad idea if he did, tried to like balance those things, those two problems. He ended up sort of paralyzed before the Denver debate. He also really had a problem, which is that a lot of his team thought he should talk about the future, that was safe ground for him. But the president kind of internally was a little frustrated with the fact that he was not running on as robust an agenda, a policy agenda, as he had in 2008, and to some extent as he wanted to in 2012. So he got himself tied in knots before that Denver debate, and the story of how he stumbled there and then had to recover for that second debate, and the stumbles along the way to that recovery are really, I think, one of the most dramatic stories that we tell in the book.
A few wrap-up items that listeners have imparted to ask of you. Clint Eastwood, he was no help for Romney. That was a blunder of colossal proportions at the convention, wasn't it?
It was, and you know, we tell the story really for the first time in the book, exactly how Clint Eastwood got up on that stage, how Mitt Romney, being sort of starstruck, led to Clint Eastwood being invited to speak in Tampa. They had met at a dinner in California, and Romney was like, "Well, I gotta love Clint Eastwood. Let's see if we can get him out." How the team, the Romney team, tried to give him a script. Eastwood refused the script. How he came up with the idea of standing out there on that stage with that chair, rather than doing what he was supposed to do, which was just talk about Mitt Romney. How he ended up talking for 12 minutes rather than 5 minutes, and the Romney team's reaction, including senior advisors throwing up backstage, and ultimately all of their worst fears about what was happening on stage coming true the next day, when Mitt Romney's big speech, the most important speech of his whole general election, was totally obliterated in the news coverage by the coverage of Clint Eastwood's Dada dinner theater.
You have a quote from Obama on Bill Clinton: "I like him in doses." That says volumes.
Well, it was the beginning of the courtship. That was from the fall of 2011. They had just decided to go out on a golf game together. It was when President Obama had decided, although he didn't particularly like President Clinton, he needed to get him on his side when he was facing this really tough re-election battle. They didn't have a great golf game. "I like him in doses" was President Obama's reaction to that. But over the course of the next year and a bit, we sort of watch in the book their relationship develop in a much more positive direction, to the point where on election night, after everything, all the water that passes between them, President Clinton helping President Obama on at the convention in Charlotte, campaigning as a surrogate for him at the very closing days of the campaign all over the country. On election night, you have Barack Obama receiving his concession call from Mitt Romney, and literally the moment that call is over, the first thing he says is, you know, get Bill Clinton on the phone. It's the first phone call that President Obama made, was to call Bill Clinton and thank him for everything that Bill Clinton had done. So, you know, we like to think of the book as somewhat as kind of the Bill and Barack bromance.
You say that Rupert Murdoch on election night said, "Our nation is ruined."
He did. Like reflecting the apocalyptic views of many millionaires and billionaires on the far right, who really felt like that their frustration over losing what they thought was a totally winnable election. You know, they had grave concerns about President Obama. They thought he was beatable. He may well have been beatable, but they ended up with Mitt Romney, who couldn't get the job done. And so Mitt Romney, Rupert Murdoch there, I think, speaking for a lot of plutocratic Republicans, far-right Republicans, whose attitude was, you know, this is a disaster. We didn't just lose an election here. You know, the country is now going to be ruined, as Rupert Murdoch says. That is not he was not alone in that view, and it's part of the thing that is going to fuel a lot of the intensity of the campaign that we're going to see 3 years from now. I don't want to start speculating about that, but there's that intensity is not diminished from our politics, and Rupert Murdoch speaks for one quadrant of it.
Well, thank you, John Heilemann. The book is Double Down, from Mark Halperin and John Heilemann, and it is quite a ride through the 2012 campaign. Tim Rutan of the Los Angeles Times writes, "Completely, compulsively readable. Once begun, you can't put it down. Deeply and knowledgeably reported and presented with all the cool sophistication one would expect from two accomplished political reporters." In just a moment, as in 90 seconds, we will hear from State Police Commander Mike Edmondson, who has been in charge of state police since 2008. 297-5633 is your number. Back after this timeout on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, 877-217-5757. Inkster Show at WRKF.org online. Mike Edmondson, the commander of state police, is with us. Colonel Edmondson, good morning to you.
Good morning, Jim. Great interview a while ago. Enjoyed listening to that. Thank you.
I appreciate it. And you've been out and about. I know you travel extensively, going from one spot to the other in all 64 parishes of our state, but just got back from New York, right?
I did. I'm actually going to Wisner, Louisiana this morning to visit with the North Louisiana chiefs and several sheriffs. One of the things that's been extremely important to me as superintendent is to make sure that we're doing everything we can to assist everyone across the state. I mean, 64 sheriffs, 330 police chiefs, I think it's a matter and an expectation from the public that we're working together and that we're interacting and making sure that we're doing everything we can because, I mean, we say it all the time, but it's true. The public could care less the color of our uniform or the shape of our badge. They just want to know that when they call the police that we're coming and that we're going to have the resources and personnel available to help them. I mean, people just want to feel safe and that's important. We keep communicating. And also, I have a 2-year stint, and as you know, we talked about it before, but I represent all the state police colonels in the country. I was voted to a 2-year position as chairman of the state and provincial, which is the International Association of Chiefs of Police. So I get a chance to see how things are done in other states and get a chance to visit with them. Had a chance in New York to see the their intelligence center, all the cameras in Manhattan that similar to what we have in New Orleans, but, of course, a much larger basis. I mean, you're dealing with 7 million people in the Manhattan area. We have 4.5 million people in Louisiana. But how they respond and how they pay attention and they interact with the public and businesses, because these cameras are a private partnership and a public partnership because most of these cameras belong to businesses and they maintain them. So the maintenance costs goes on the company, and they share them with the police and when things happen, they can go back and look, or they can be aggressive and proactive. And that's something we've been doing for 6 years in Louisiana now is being extremely proactive. Where are the problems occurring? Where is the crime occurring? Where are the crashes occurring and the DWI arrests occurring? Those types of things. And just interacting with the public, because I just believe that if you listen to people, they'll tell you what's going on. Same thing we're doing here with the school safety initiative.
Well, since you brought that up, in light of the tragedy in Connecticut, nearly a year old now, what has been done in Louisiana? Can you really curb or combat or react to something that might or might not happen?
And just to let you know, the school task force initiative, we're actually meeting tomorrow morning around 10:30 at GOSEB. Task force team is going to meet and talk about what we've done so far. We've put together a packet of information. It's called a school safety checklist. We looked out around the country and said, where, what are other states doing? What are other locations doing? What are they doing in Connecticut now? And then we kind of took it and made it Louisiana, a Louisiana flavor to it. And we have a complete checklist where a school can go through each one of these and say, yes, I have it. No, I don't. Does it apply? Not do we are we doing it? How can we improve it? And it's a work in progress. It looks at the school exterior, the play areas where the kids are, the classroom, the doors, the locks. You know, we have over 2,200 schools in Louisiana, and I was on the phone almost immediately with the governor that day, and certainly staff and people and legislators around the state. What are we doing in Louisiana? Are we prepared? And we. Along with, of course, with our partnership with the sheriffs and the chiefs of police are in schools all the time. And the fire department, your local fire departments, they're in and out of the schools, Jim, checking for, of course, safety issues and stuff like that. And plus just listening to the kids. Saw on TV this morning with the sheriff's office, East Baton Rouge Parish, and Sheriff Gotro, who does such a great job, Mike Gaz and Jason Ard and of course, Jeff Wiley and other sheriffs in the area, they do such a great job in our schools of actually sitting there and looking and listening and just being proactive. So we've done that in schools around the state. And I can tell you, as we look at the situation that's happened across the country and certainly in Connecticut, we can say in Louisiana that our schools are safe. And then we can also say that prevention does not require prediction. And what I mean by that is to sit there and try to predict where things are going to happen. You'll spend all your time trying to figure out, well, where's the next person going to do something crazy? But I think if you can just put prevention in all areas and awareness in all areas, then you're ahead of the game there. And the third thing is that threat assessments do work. If we work on what type of threat would this place have, that's where you deal with the prevention. And when you look at what we have in Louisiana, I mean, look at an LSU game. There's 150,000 people on campus for a major LSU football game. Look at a Saints game in New Orleans and who attends those. And look at where you go, the ULL, or you're in Lafayette, whether you're at Southeastern, whether you're in Monroe, whether you're in, Lake Charles or Shreveport or any points in between. Look at our high school football games and the number of people right here in Baton Rouge. I pass Olympia Stadium sometimes, and it's hard to drive down the road. There's so many people packed into that stadium. So we have to look at where are large amounts of people, whether it's in a mall, whether it's in a church, whether it's in a playground, and we have to look at some type of prevention measures and what type of threat assessment in Louisiana.
All right, 297-5633 for Colonel Mike Edmondson of State Police. Dan downtown. Dan, good morning. You're on the air with Mike Edmondson.
Good morning. Colonel, do you agree with the Police Chiefs Association that crime prevention would be enhanced by more gun control, and that is not inconsistent with the Second Amendment?
Jimmy, it went out when he first started asking
right,
the question.
Dan,
so
you want to repose the question, Dan?
Sure. Do you agree with the Police Chiefs Association that crime prevention would be enhanced by more gun control and that doing that would not be inconsistent with the Second Amendment?
Well, I think what we have to look at, and certainly I think you have to review all those matters, Dan, and that's a good question and certainly something that's on people's minds. We've also got to make sure that the right people, the wrong people don't get the guns, and that's your background checks. That's looking to see, to make sure that if I'm a convicted felon, have any type of issues that does not warrant a gun, if mental instability, those types of things, there ought to be a mechanism in place, and there is. We've got to make sure that they're applied in every incident, because when you look at what goes on out there, I think there's two common denominators in Louisiana on violent crimes. There's illegal guns and drugs, and I think you've got to tie those issues in. So that's all prevalent. Look, I believe that people have the right to keep and bear arms, absolutely, and you should have that. We've just got to make sure that the wrong people don't get them, and we've got to look at that. I think there's several areas that you've got to do, and it's got to be a constant evolving of maintaining that database and maintaining that information, and I think that's what we have to do a better job on.
297-5633, Hugh at LSU. Hugh, you're on with Colonel Edmondson. Hi, Hugh.
How you doing? Listen, Colonel Edmondson, I've enjoyed watching your trajectory throughout the years down here, and I admire you. I think you're a straightforward man. Have you ever considered running for politics? I'm serious.
Well, that's a very nice thing to say. I was asked that a while back, and the only thing I can say is that it certainly means I'm doing a good job. And police work and public safety, that can change at any time because you're thrown in so many different directions. But I've been in law enforcement now 34 years. I'll finish out my term with under Governor Jindal, as I committed to do so, and then look at where the Lord is going to take me. I believe he's got something else in store for me, and certainly if everything aligns right, I'd certainly like to look at things in the future. But I've got a job to do now, whether it's the school safety portion, our violent crime in Louisiana, and I want to make sure I continue to concentrate on those things because that's what the public wants me to do. And if the good Lord has plans for me, then maybe that'll happen in the future. But right now, I'm really committed to running state police and running public safety. But thank you for those kind remarks.
Now, there was, and I think still is, speculation that you might run for lieutenant governor. Or do you want to discount that, or are you looking at that?
No, I'm certainly not. I'm not looking at anything right now other than the job that I have. But that it's very intriguing. I mean, I love. I've never been exactly involved in politics, but I certainly love the thought of it. It seemed like something, especially in that position, you market Louisiana, you market things, and, you know, there's a lot of things that we can do differently out there, and I'd certainly like to be a part of that, but that's a year and a half away to even make a decision like that, and I don't want to get bogged down, nor to think the public thinks that I'm thinking of something else, because my 110%, 150% of my attention's got to be on public safety, because whether it's state police, motor vehicle, fire marshal, gaming, it takes a lot of time and effort to do that, and I think it would be unfair to the public for me to try to run for another job when I have a job. I've never believed in that. I've never believed when I see politicians that are running for another office when they have one. I don't get that. I think that you ought to be concentrating on a job that you have and making sure that job's done, and I certainly want to do that. I've had a great career in state police. I want it to continue, and like I said, if the good Lord has something else in store for me, I pray hard about it all the time, and we'll see where it takes me. But I'm enjoying life. I've got four kids, beautiful wife, just a wonderful atmosphere, and I've loved state police, and I want to go out in a very positive manner.
Joshua in Mid-City. Joshua, you're on with Colonel Edmondson. Oops. Let's try HB in Denham Springs. HB, good morning. You're on the air with Mike Edmondson.
Good morning. Colonel, with the budget restrictions that have been placed upon you since your appointment as Colonel of State Police, you certainly had to do more with a lot less with not even having academies. Tonight there's going to be a special on TV by Channel 9 on some of the officers and sheriff's deputies that are working up to 90 hours a week. If you could and had the power within yourself to be able to do so, how many troopers do you need? What starting salary would you have them start out for to where they did not have to work all the extra duty? And last but not least is what is the future of state police in your mind, and how could it be improved? Thank you, sir.
Well, that's a great question and a pretty in-depth one also. But let me just tell you this. I did get approval for a state police academy. As you know, we graduated our last one in February of 2009. We've been as high as 1,141 troopers statewide. We're now at around 923. So I have a 50-man class or 50-person class that will start January the 12th, so I'm very, very pleased with that. I also have assurance that we'll have a class, at least one class a year for the next 4 years after that. This is being taken from debt recovery money that people owe money to the state of Louisiana. The first $5 million will come off the top of that, and we'll go to state police to have a class. So that's a positive thing. You know, you're certainly right. For the past 6 years, we've reduced the size of government as far as public safety is concerned by almost 520 positions and right at $105 million. So we've created efficiencies. We've reduced duplications. We're doing things at a much more efficient pace, and I think that's a good thing, but I think we're at our point where we certainly can't go any lower. When you look at the salaries of police officers, I certainly believe that when you look at public servants and whether we're talking about teachers, firefighters, emergency response personnel, police officers, they ought to be paid a fair salary. They shouldn't have to go out and work extra hours so they can have a family, can have a way of life, and I think you've got to look at that. There's got to be a median. Because if you look in Louisiana, police officers are paid anywhere from around $20,000 a year to start to one place when it's upper $40,000 a year to start.
State trooper
starts at $34,000 a year, between $34,000 and $36,000 a year. After 1 year, they're making around $41,000 a year. We have limited overtime. We don't work overtime and store and you know, restaurants and bars and business and banks and stuff like that, but we do have extra hours on the interstate, whether it's speeding enforcement or DWI, and also we have some very limited overtime towards investigations. But I believe if you're going to have because that's who you turn to during emergencies when things are going bad, when the lights go out. I mean, you're looking for the police, and I don't try to differentiate between a sheriff's deputy or a state trooper or a city police officer or a fireman or a first responder. We're all in this together, and I think that you ought to pay the individuals exactly your expectation and worth of that position. And to me, it warrants looking at it for any other perspective as far as a public servant. And we've got to look at that. We've got to be smart about it.
All right, Joshua in Mid-City. try again. Joshua, you're on with Mike Edmondson.
Hi, Mr. Edmondson, Mr. Angster. You mentioned earlier that drugs were a driver of violent crime in Baton Rouge. I wanted to know what your thoughts were on the place of decriminalization in the debate on violent crime. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Okay. He went out again in a minute.
All right, dude. What about drugs and violent crime and decriminalization?
Well, when you look at marijuana, you now have several states that are have already decriminalized it. You've got around 19 that will consider it during legislation over the next 1 to 2 years. So it's certainly something we have to look at from a law enforcement perspective. Chief Batiste, head of Washington State Patrol, is a dear friend of mine. We've had some great conversations about that. Joe Farah, the superintendent in California. So we have constant conversations and how they're dealing with it. I said it earlier, but it's true. When you look at almost 80% of your violent crime in Louisiana, the correlation is drugs or illegal weapons. I think Baton Rouge takes about 100 guns a month off of the streets in Baton Rouge, about the same number in New Orleans. We're going through a task force right now statewide, and I think we've already seized around 40 or 50 guns that we've taken off the streets across the state. So it is a problem that you've got to look at, and we've got to look at those particular things. The other thing that concerns me is the fact that heroin has made its way back into our society, especially south of Interstate 10, and that concerns us. We know what's coming out of Mexico. I got a chance to travel to the Rio Grande in McAllen, Texas, with my counterpart in Texas, Steve McCraw, and got to see firsthand what's coming across the Rio Grande, and it's disturbing, because whether it's human trafficking, whether it's illegal drugs, that's what's coming into Louisiana, and we have to. And it's about a 60-mile area on the river where it's coming across. So we know that. We're working with it. We're dealing with it. We're making some tremendous strides and arrests, and not just the person selling on the streets, but the person that's bringing it in, and from that status. So we've just got to work harder on that. We've got to make sure those partnerships with the other agencies are there, and also with the federal government. That's where you make a difference, but drugs are prevalent. We've kind of come full circle, I believe, when you look in schools, because you're seeing marijuana still in the schools. And, of course, the drug of choice now for our teenagers is alcohol. I mean, that's the drug of choice now, and it's heavily used on our college campuses throughout Louisiana, which is also disturbing to me. So I think we've got to make sure we continue the educational side of it. I think you've got to make sure these kids understand the responsibility when they do partake in this, and what can happen to them and will happen to them if they're caught. And I think you just got to keep driving that. But I will reiterate the fact about heroin, because it is something that's come back into Louisiana. It's been here, but I think the numbers are much higher, and we're seeing that in the overdoses. We're seeing that in the deaths. While we're targeting that portion of the drugs throughout Louisiana, right?
297-5633. We'll be back to spend a few more minutes with Mike Edmondson. Also hear from Sean Daniels, the director of Dove, premiering at Swine Palace at LSU. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. A few more minutes with Commander Mike Edmondson of State Police. Amy in Prairieville. Amy, good morning. You're on with Colonel Edmondson.
Good morning. How are you, Colonel?
Good morning, Amy.
I just wanted to give you a little background before I ask my question, if I could. I was a past director of the Motorcycle Awareness Campaign for a couple of years. Because in 07, I was involved in a crash. My husband, Jim, was killed, and I was very seriously injured. So I went to the legislature with legislation to up the penalties for right-of-way violations. And we did pass one piece of legislation in 09, and subsequently we went in 10 and 11. We didn't pass for all of the 13 right-of-way violations. However, the problem that I see happening is that on the roadways, you know that we have a lot of motorcycle fatalities, motorcycle incidents. We're not getting the right-of-way violations ticketed, and there it's not going to the district attorneys, and that particular piece of legislation is not being enforced. So I wanted to know how the disconnect happens between the troopers writing the tickets and then it going to the district attorneys and going to the court system.
Well, first of all, you're exactly correct on the right of way. Whether it's bicycles or whether it's motorcycles, I mean that is a thing that we see. And one thing about a motorcycle crash, even a minor one, is a major one because of just the injuries involved. We do write those. I don't know the exact number, but I'm making a note right now to check into that to see exactly how many we are writing and where they're occurring. And I'll also follow up to make sure that if we're not, that we start addressing in the areas that we need to. And if there's a problem that it's we're writing them and either the district attorneys aren't getting them or somewhere in the court or judicial system they're falling out, I'll do everything I can to try to correct that, because I think that's something we see almost daily, unfortunately. And that's unfortunate, certainly, about your injury and certainly about your husband's passing, because that's something that we can, by paying attention, by enforcing the laws, we can keep those things from happening and do everything we can. So I will make a point this morning to actually follow up on that for you and find out where the disconnect is. And if it's something I can correct, I'll correct it. If it's not, I'll find a person that can.
Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Hi, Phil. You're on with Mike.
Good morning, Tim. Good morning, Mr. Edmondson.
Good morning, Phil.
My question for you, sir, is, I mean, Louisiana's got the most lax gun laws in the country, and we didn't talk about non-lethal forms of self-defense like mace and pepper spray, because your officers risk their lives every day whenever they stop somebody in traffic that there might be a gun in that car. And conversely, citizens are treated as if they're armed. So it's just a dangerous situation, sir.
Well, I mean, you're exactly right. We've had some very horrendous altercations with individuals. Police officers have lost their lives. Guns across the country have been problematic and a lot of arrests. We pull our guns now more as police officers or have over the past probably 2 to 3 years than we have in the last 7 or 8 years. And I think as you look at that, you talk about guns. Look, I believe in people having the right to have guns. Learn how to use them. Use them safely. Store them safely in your house. Keep them away from kids. As your kids grow up, if you have guns in your home, teach them how to properly use them. I mean, that's one of the biggest problems we have, especially in safety, is that in handling the guns, they don't know how to use it. Or when they do use it, they use it improperly. And if you're going to have a gun, you've got to treat it. It's a lethal weapon. I mean, it can kill someone, and it has. And I think we have to do everything we can to make sure, like I said earlier, that the people that want to have gun permits, that want to have the right to have their arms, they ought to do so responsibly. And we've got to do everything we can to make sure that the wrong people that shouldn't have the guns, they don't have them. So I think we've got to continue to do work on that. And I think the safety aspect is something that is something that's extremely large, and we've got to do everything we can to work with that.
James in Mid-City. James, you're on with Colonel Edmondson. Hi, James.
Hi, good morning. I just had a question about Colonel Edmondson in the beginning was talking about getting back from New York City and the private cameras up there, and also how perhaps New Orleans is based on that system in terms of using private companies to gather personal information or photographs. And I was wondering if he thought that was perhaps a contradiction in terms as far as being analogous to other public entities relying on private companies to do that, to fulfill that function.
Just as far as to tell you the cameras and stuff like that, from what I've seen and what I saw, it's not something that's maintained and goes into a database or anything like that. I think that these are cameras that businesses have for security purposes, so that if something occurs in an area, you can go back and look at the camera to determine, you know, what happened. I think an instance I saw in New York where they could actually go real time to an area and watch something. If a crime has occurred, a bank robbery, a theft, a violent crime, you can actually look real time at that location. I think we saw that as a world. We saw that in Times Square when the explosive material was found inside the vehicle. So I think that's something that's a very positive for us. I think look, we extra eyes and ears out there on the roadways and the highways and our public is certainly something that's needed in law enforcement. We need the public to work with us. I think when we can partner with a business that already has cameras and those things in place, then that's something that we don't have to expend that cost on, and it ought to be a partnership. But, you know, I don't believe in delving in people's personal lives. I don't believe in looking into people's homes or cars or whatever when you're not supposed to. But I think having them there is a deterrent to crime. And we think when people see cameras in areas, then you know what, they stay away from those areas. Same thing with lights. I mean, we can't all afford cameras. I certainly can't. So you know what, turn your lights on around your house. I mean, when people, we talk to criminals. We're in prisons. We're talking to criminals. They don't go in areas that are lit. You know, they don't go in areas where people are trying to deter themselves from crime. They tend to stay away from those areas, and I think that's something that you've got to look at. And these crime cameras, they have a place. I'm not a proponent of the speeding cameras and those types of things. I don't believe in that. And I believe that's revenue-based enforcement. I've never been a proponent of that. But I do believe there's a place, especially in the for deterrent of crime, as far as a security system to where you've got a camera and stuff like that. And we can go in and use that and share that with the public to try to either solve a crime or to keep one from occurring. I'm all for it.
Okay. A few other questions, and we'll let you go. A listener wants to know if you're still friends with Nick Saban.
I spoke to Nick yesterday. And I told him because I know him extremely well and do talk to him quite often. But I couldn't believe when I saw it at the end of the game when he just jumped up into A.J. McCarron's arms. I said, wow, you don't normally see that type of personality from Nick. But I told him, he said, you know what, I've worked all year to get the team to a level to where they have to respond. And the first half was great for LSU, not so great for Alabama. And I really thought the momentum was there, and I thought the second half we're going to come out, we're going to get the football, and we're going to go. And unfortunately, Alabama made the changes they did, and we just didn't have a good second half. And that takes nothing away from LSU. Look, I love LSU, and I think they've got a great team, a great coach and staff, and. I think we're going to do well. It's just we just expect us to win every time. I was on the sidelines for 27 years. I know that. I was there during some horrible times and some great times. But I just applauded Nick because he's done well. And I just asked him why he got so excited. And I just think that he's very close to AJ there. He's like a father figure to him, and he's the leader of the team. And they just did what they needed to do to win. So. He was excited, but you're right. We don't normally see that, and we certainly don't normally see that from Coach Saban. But I had a chance to visit with him yesterday, and he said he's still got a lot of football ahead this year, and it's nothing's easy.
Yeah, when you're on the phone with him, Mike, do you get the sense that he can't wait to get off the phone? Does he ever relax?
Yeah, I don't think he ever relaxes. And I mean, I have hundreds of stories on him and all the coaches over the years, and. He's a constant worker, and if you're a good football player, he's going to make you better. And but he's going to do it the right way. And look, we have that with Coach Miles. I've spent the same amount of time with him, and their belief and love in Louisiana when they're here was certainly evident. I mean, Coach Miles constantly wants to know what's that? What do you do here? What's going on here? I mean, Coach Miles' dad was a police officer. Coach Saban was the same way. Coach Saban is a much more aggressively, inwardly person. I mean, he's always constantly working. I mean, and I used to have to just to do different things and say, you know, get off the phone, you know, enjoy what's going on around you, because he was always working.
Well, thank you, Mike. No, you are too. Headed for Wisner. We thank you for spending time with us today, and let's do it again.
Yes, sir. Well, maybe next time we'll talk about the I'm going to have a chance to see the Google driverless car.
Yeah.
I have a chance to actually ride in it. So that could be kind of scary, but that's the wave of the future. And I'm gonna actually ride in the car with the superintendent of the California Highway Patrol. So it should be something interesting.
You're doing that next week, aren't you?
Yeah, it's actually coming. We're going to see it. And they're telling us that it's within the next 10 years. It's riding all over California on a 24-hour basis, and we're actually going to meet the inventors of it and the young guys and ladies that actually are actually building the future. And every time they send something in the car, they build a program to look at it. So I'm interested to see, because I think that's what we're going to have to deal with in the future, and it's certainly coming.
Well, thank you, Colonel Edmondson. Keep up the good work.
Thank you, sir.
Take care. Bye-bye. We're joined now in studio by Sean Daniels, the director of Dove, premiering at Swine Palace. Good morning, Sean.
Good morning.
And I remember a production that you were involved with. I think you were the lead man for Heist.
Yeah, we had a great time doing that.
You had Les Miles involved with Heist.
That's right, that.
Yeah. Well, tell us about Dove, opening tomorrow night. Right?
Opening tomorrow night. So this is a world premiere production. It's actually part of a partnership with the O'Neill Center in Waterford, Connecticut, that involved work transferring between the United States, Russia, Estonia, and Latvia. So all over the world. And Swine Palace is one of the centers here in America. So this is an Estonian playwright who wrote a comedy about what does it mean to be an artist, a really kind of wacky, very fun comedy. So he's over here. We have an Estonian playwright here. We'll do the world premiere. Meanwhile, there's American work being premiered in Latvia. So it's an international kind of exchange. So it's great for us to be able to be a part of it here, to be able to share what's going on with the community here, and for Swine Palace to really take this kind of global lead in terms of bringing new work to the stage.
And you have a young man joining you in studio?
Yes.
Anthony McMurray?
Yes, who is one of our lead actors in the show here.
Anthony, good morning to you.
Good morning, Jim.
So you'll be playing which role?
I'll be playing Mart Indrik, who is kind of the leading man of the theater. He was a television star in Estonia, and now as he has started aging, has moved on stage and sort of behind the mic doing radio voiceovers and so on and so forth.
Yeah, well, so. I can see you're well suited for that role. but how do you do the aging part? You're not an old man.
Well, the bald spot creeps in, and that just says it all.
we try to light that specifically from above,
exactly.
And then everyone knows where we are.
Yeah, bald spot cam.
Well, Sean is an innovative director, and that was proved with Heist. That was something that was an outside-the-box presentation.
Well, I got to give credit to Swine Palace and to George Judy, who runs it, that they're continually taking real chances and really putting the program in the front by doing these type of shows that are a little out of the box and really grab national attention and really focus not only the people here to know what's going on, but nationwide to look around and say, who's doing the really interesting stuff that we'll all be talking about 10 or 15 years from now.
Well, Dove, as you say, is a world premiere, actually one of two world premieres, an Estonian comedy. Now, that some would say that's an oxymoron.
I think if the Russians were to invade your country from time to time, you'd probably come up with a good sense of humor also about how to keep yourself entertained.
Who else is in the play?
We have it's actually the MFA students that are here, mm-hmm. and then several graduates from the past year. And we've been working on it actually for several months leading up to it. So it's great for them to be able to kind of inhabit this world. And I think one of the things that's interesting that you mentioned is what you'd think of as an Estonian comedy actually is amazingly universal. That many of the same things that the Estonians are thinking about, what does it mean to be an artist? What does it mean to fall in love? Can you have a family and be an artist at the same time? How funny is it for someone to fall into over a couch, into a door, who has crazy fans. Like, all the same things that we would laugh at are the things that they would laugh at. So that's kind of the amazing universality of this comedy.
And the lead actor is Anthony McMurray. Where are you from, Anthony?
Originally from Kansas City, Kansas.
And how did you end up at LSU?
I just came down to get my MFA at LSU and, finished that up last May, and now I'm sticking around. My fiance's in the MFA program, so we're going to be around for at least a couple more years. Yeah. She's also in the show.
And she is from where?
She's originally from Colorado, just a little outside of Denver.
Yeah, that's not that unusual, Sean. A lot of the students from LSU, they come from all over the country and all over the world.
Yeah, and then they stay because they love it.
Yeah, well, the production is Dove. It premieres tomorrow night. It'll be on which stage?
It'll be in the Studio Theater, which is in the Music and Dramatic Arts Building at the corner of Dalrymple Drive and Infirmary.
So the big one in the Studio Theater, Dove, and it runs for how long?
Two weekends.
So Anthony McMurray, good luck to you.
Thank you.
Imagine you've been preparing for a few days.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. He's been preparing all his life for this role.
Yeah. Does he sing?
We all sort of sing at the very top of the show. We have we found a little Estonian tune that we sort of come on and do.
Can you give us a little sampling here?
Well, here's the thing is we actually couldn't pronounce any of the words, so the entire song is sung la 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 la.
Yeah,
That's a good start. Sean Daniels back with Dove after getting rave reviews for Heist.
Oh, great!
And Anthony McMurray on stage as the lead actor, the man from Kansas City. Thank you. Good luck to you.
Great.
Tomorrow night, opening. What's the time? Tomorrow?
7:30, correct? Yes, 7:30.
7:30 tomorrow night. Until next time, I'm Jim Engster. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.